they have a plan for how the health aides can operate in a secure environment. They will get busy trying to hire again.
Health aides quit their post in Nunam Iqua, citing unsafe working conditions. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, the 16th of April. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a post-mortem PFD.
The rules now state that an applicant needed to be a resident of the state the entire year, which effectively means you have to be alive the entire year.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by North Rim Bank, reminding you that you have a second chance to help other Alaskans. If you filed for your PFD online, you can safely donate a portion of your dividend to your favorite Alaska cause. Log into the PFD website and pick, click, give. And by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com.
The legislature has just 2 days left to meet the 90-day session limit voters have demanded. They have left a lot of the high-profile issues for the last minute and are still working on finding some consensus on others. This morning, the House Finance Committee released its version of the capital projects budget that drew attention because of its size when the Senate first released it. This morning's version spends even more money. For a preview of the days ahead, let's go to APRN's Dave Donaldson at the Capitol. Hi, Dave.
Hi.
Let's start with the capital budget that appeared in the House today. How much larger is it?
It adds about $170 million to what the Senate has already approved. The big one is a $57 million for the railroad to extend its line to Point McKenzie in the Mat-Su. You know, to put this into perspective, yeah, it's a big budget, and most people are using the governor's numbers of near $3 billion for spending. That includes $1 billion in federal money, and some $400 million of it will also be given to voters and ask them to approve it. So it takes it down to about $1.5 billion. It's still large, but it's not quite as large as it sounds, to make it sound quite as bad as it has before.
Well, Dave, how about some of the other major bills? What's taking so long?
Well, there are some serious arguments about the details on a few of them. This oil and gas separation tax bill, a lot of people just haven't decided if the risk is likely or if passing it will put the success of the North Slope gas line at risk. How necessary is it? Or is it we're heading for disaster if we don't do it? I mean, it's some shocking and conflicting numbers, depending on where you look at it. Both sides really are torn up over the question right now, and it's all in the House.
There's a couple of other high-priority bills, one that sets up a formula and a way to finance school construction. That's become a major issue, particularly for rural Alaska.
It's a primary concern for rural issues. It is in an awkward place, however. I think they've been pushing it hard. They've been playing it right, and it's done very well. But it's unfortunately stuck in a line with a lot of these super bills that are very complicated, very divisive. That particular bill is in the House Finance Committee, just one step away from a floor vote. There are 109 other bills in that one committee. And that is what it's up against right now because it's this time of the season.
There's been some legislation put forward by Senator Donnie Olson and Representative Reggie Jewell, both Bush Caucus, Northwest Alaska Coastal lawmakers, a legislative effort to sort of roll back some of the changes that were made to coastal zone management during the Murkowski administration. Has that gone anywhere?
It has gotten as far as in the Senate, in the Rules Committee. Still don't know if it's going to go anywhere. There's still got one more day there that it perhaps could be successful if it comes up tomorrow. But again, it's also in one of these same conditions where it's just a matter of so many other things. Will it get the rest of the way across, through both House and Senate?
Sounds like it's going to be a very long weekend, Mr. Donaldson.
I think so.
Well, thanks for that update, Dave.
You're welcome.
APRN's Dave Donaldson reporting from Juneau. Alaskans will fight for their right to a permanent fund dividend check, and now a bill passed by the State House yesterday allows beneficiaries of the deceased to collect. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer has more.
The bill, SB 171, sponsored by Anchorage Senator Kevin Meyer, rests on the governor's desk. The State House approved the bill in a 31-8 vote. If Governor Parnell signs it, some qualifying deceased Alaskans will be issued permanent fund checks in October of next year. A dead Alaskan's survivors can apply for the deceased's dividend check and collect. Permanent Fund Division Director Deborah Bitney says the deceased's estate or anyone who has legal authority is eligible to collect a deceased person's PFD under current rules anyway, if the deceased lived the entire year prior to the filing period. The bill only reduces the length of time that the deceased needed to be alive in the qualifying year.
The legislation that just passed extends that period of time about 6 months. The rules now state that an applicant needed to be a resident of the state the entire year, which effectively means you have to be alive the entire year. What this legislation does is that you need to be a resident 180 days in the qualifying year instead of the entire qualifying year.
Bitney says eligibility for the PFD for the deceased is about the same as it is for the living. That includes a 180-day residency in the state while still alive. Bitney says one of the provisions in the legislation makes it mandatory that the deceased was eligible for a PFD in the previous year when he or she was still alive.
That provision was basically included so that fraud wasn't such an issue. These are obviously Alaskans that have been in the dividend system, and that in and of itself will probably reduce a huge amount of potential fraud.
Half of the 3,500 Alaskans that die every year would be eligible for the check. Bitney estimates that about 1,700 more PFD checks will be cut next year, but that is not going to add too much to the workload of the division.
The actual process for determining eligibility is not that difficult in this case because they do have to have received a dividend prior. So it takes out quite a bit of the man work that would be required if that wasn't a requirement.
Representative Berta Gardner opposed the bill, saying the state needs to draw a line concerning eligibility. The sticking point in the legislation was the word resident, according to Bitney, since a resident, by definition, is a living person. Permanent fund dividends are subject to federal income taxes and must be reported to the Internal Revenue Service. Bitney says she's not sure if a deceased's PFD is subject to estate taxes. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska State Troopers and Village Public Safety Officers have swept into a coastal village after the high-profile resignation of village health aides there. Two healthcare workers quit their jobs in the village of Nunum Iqua, saying conditions there were unsafe. From member station KYUK in Bethel, Shane Iverson reports.
Arrests are up in the tiny coastal village following a new push to beef up law enforcement there. Alaska State Trooper Lieutenant David Tracy.
What we've done is sent a trooper that's stationed in St. Mary's, who is normally responsible for public safety matters in that region, on a temporary duty assignment to stay in the village of Nunum Iqua for the next 2 weeks.
The village public safety officer program has also now moved two officers there. This after two health aides resigned their position, leaving the remote village without anyone to provide medical assistance. Until now, the village has been without a law enforcement presence, and aides there said they faced constant harassment and threats from fellow villagers who would demand service even when conditions were unsafe. Many of those situations arose out of alcohol-related violence or injuries. Bill Schreiner is the health aid director for the Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Corporation. He said the organization has stood behind the aides' decision to resign.
We understood that these are deep and important issues for them, and they needed to make the best decision for themselves and their families.
tribal, health, and law enforcement agencies met last week in Nunamiqua to come up with a plan to continue medical services in the village.
Our commitment to the folks in the village was when either troopers or a similar kind of presence could be available, then we would match up, to the best of our ability, we would match up with itinerant health aides.
For now, two health aides from CHIVAC are filling in, but how long that will last is unclear. Lieutenant Tracy says troopers are already spread thin in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta, which includes 56 villages.
Try to utilize those resources in the most effective way possible, and unfortunately, we're unable to provide a trooper in a village the size of Nunamiqua.
VPSO Coordinator Alvin Jimmy says he's been trying to post an officer there for some time already.
But pursuing applicants, I have yet to find one or have yet to find an interest candidate to be a VPSO for Nunamiqua.
VPSOs and troopers say they can manage another week of staffing there, but there's several issues to resolve before a stronger presence can be established, like where exactly an officer could work or even sleep. Again, Lieutenant Tracy.
Right now, we don't have any state housing or permanent lodging available to us, so we use a combination of places normally when we do a village visit, and those would include the health clinic, the school in some places, or if there's other private lodging available.
Some villages employ tribal police, which are paid for with their own revenues, but tribal police are less prevalent in smaller communities like Nunamiqua, where there's fewer people and less revenue is generated. YKHC's Bill Schreiner says the Health Corporation wants to continue to serve the village, but he says ultimately it lies in their hands.
This is something that the folks in Nunam are going to come up with a solution on, and if they have a plan for how the health aides can operate in a secure environment, that we'll get busy trying to hire again.
Reporting from Bethel, I'm Shane Iverson.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a hunter ponders whether he's bagged a grizzly or a growler bear.
It's a really nice, really thick fur, but almost like white body, and the legs are pretty dark.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the Association of Alaska School Boards. Parents that read to their children foster early learning and educational development for children and youth. Information at aasb.org. And by
Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for over 50 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. Crowley.com.
The body of a missing Fairbanks woman was found yesterday. State troopers report that Samantha Lee Randolph's body was discovered near where her car was found, stuck off China Hot Springs Road last December. Trooper spokeswoman Megan Peters says a passerby found a purse in the same area on Wednesday and alerted troopers.
And once troopers were on scene and began searching around, they were able to locate the body of Ms. Randolph. And at this time, it doesn't appear that there's any signs of foul play, but we are sending the body to Anchorage to get an autopsy done.
The 40-year-old Randolph was facing a manslaughter charge stemming from a vehicle surfing accident last summer involving a man she was driving with who climbed out on the hood, fell, and died. The National Park Service has banned some controversial bear hunting practices in parts of Denali and Gates of the Arctic National Preserves. The techniques involve the harvest of black bears at dens in state game management units that overlap parts of the preserves. The practices legalized by the game board include the killing of bear cubs or sows with cubs and the use of artificial light to harvest bears in dens. The Park Service is required to defer to state regulation under the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act, but has leeway to contradict when game populations or rural subsistence are threatened. Park Service spokesman John Quinley says the bear harvest practices aren't acceptable for the preserve lands.
This is a case where we looked at the purposes for the national preserves and felt that this was not an appropriate method, that it had potential, because it was a method open to all Alaskans, it had the potential to affect bear populations, and we moved to take action to stop that practice, having already asked the state to take action on its own.
The State Game Board approved the bear denning practices in response to a proposal which sought the return of the traditional harvest techniques. The Park Service's move to halt bear denning at Denali and Gates of the Arctic follows a decision earlier this week to suspend sport wolf hunting and trapping at Yukon Charley Rivers Preserve. Special Assistant to the Commissioner of Game, Tina Cunning, says the moves are unprecedented in the history of ANILCA.
We really need to resolve with the National Park Service what the criteria is that they use to trump the state's management authority. That's really important for the long haul. ANILCA was a very controversial bill. A lot of Alaska residents very concerned about this type of activity occurring. Congress tried to protect the state's management authorities, and that's why it's never been done in the 30 years.
Cunning says the state doesn't believe game populations or rural subsistence are at risk in either of the current cases. She says the Park Service failed to adequately consult, as required by law, with the state before making this week's closures. She says the state wants to resolve the conflict with the Park Service without legal action. In Canada's Northwest Territories, a hunter from Lhuhuktuk says he's not sure what species of bear he's killed. The bear looks like a polar bear, but has brown legs and other features of a grizzly. If it's confirmed by DNA tests, it would be the second hybrid bear discovery. The CBC's Philippe Morin reports from Inuvik.
David Kuptana first saw the bear while he was scavenging through some unoccupied cabins just outside Lhuhuktuk.
He sure galloped pretty fast. He was running towards town. I took my rifle out and took a shot at it, even though it was quite a ways, and managed to hit it. When I stopped it after it killed it, I said, holy smokes, this bear looked different, you know.
Kuptana skinned the bear and put the pelt in a freezer. Since then, he's had a steady stream of neighbors coming to see it.
It's a really nice, really thick fur, but almost like white body, and the legs are pretty dark.
Kuptana says the bear looks like a polar bear. However, it has a wide head and long claws, which are typical of a grizzly. The question is whether or not he's found the world's second confirmed grolder bear, which is a mix between the species.
If this is a hybrid bear, I'll be really happy to, you know, get the second one in the north.
The NWT Department of Environment and Natural Resources is conducting a DNA test, which could take a few weeks. Philippe Morin, CBC News, Inuvik.
The North Pacific Fisheries Research Foundation and groups of fishermen have developed and tested a new style of Chinook salmon excluder device for pollock trawl nets. The innovation arrives just in time to help address the Chinook salmon bycatch hard cap rules that are going into place. KUCB's Ann Hillman found out how it works.
The new Chinook salmon excluder device uses a flexible weighted panel that keeps pollock in but lets salmon out. John Galvin with the North Pacific Fisheries Research Foundation says the new design takes advantage of the differences in swimming abilities between pollock and salmon.
Salmon can swim forward in a pollock trawl, whereas pollock are not strong enough swimmers to do that on a sustained basis. So what we've done is changed the water flow and created a way for salmon to move out of the fish coming down the net and power up and swim up to an area where there's an escapement hole.
Galvin says they've been experimenting with excluders since 2003. The original designs involved rigid squares of mesh, but those caused problems when the nets caught large schools of pollock. The flexibility of the new design eliminates that problem.
So little by little, we moved into the using a panel that would just be weighted and hang down, but could accommodate larger catch rates of pollock because it would, in those circumstances, just push up and still protect the escapement hole, but it would allow fish to swim past it without restricting the flow anymore.
He and his colleagues started developing this design in 2007. Then, in the spring of 2009, the North Pacific Fisheries Management Council instituted a hard cap limit on the number of Chinook salmon brought in as bycatch by the pollock fishery. If a boat catches more than their allotted number of Chinook, then they have to either trade for another boat's allocation or stop fishing altogether. It's strong motivation to avoid Chinook if at all possible. In the fall of 2009, Galvin and others started to fine-tune the excluder design in a flume tank that allowed them to quickly test different scenarios and conditions. Then, they field-tested the modified design on two pollock boats this February. One boat saw 35% escapement of Chinook salmon, and the other had 25%. Only 1% of pollock escaped. Galvin says the tests were too small to be statistically significant, but they learned that each excluder needs to be fine-tuned and properly weighted depending on the horsepower of the boat. Galvin says the modification cost less than $10,000 and can be made to any pollock trawl net.
Yes, designed to just be an inserted section into anybody's pollock net. So it's a separate sort of straight tube of webbing with the excluder panel in it that would be put just at the end of the tapered part of the trawl and just before the stuffing tube or caught end section, depending on how the net's rigged.
About 50 boats are already using them. The North Pacific Fisheries Research Foundation will host workshops in May to teach fishermen how they work. If the fishermen choose to install one, a technician will help them fine-tune the gear at the beginning of bee season. Next, they'll begin developing an excluder for chum salmon, which behaves differently than king salmon. In Unalaska, I'm Ann Hillman.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. Begin your UAF fisheries degree at any major University of Alaska campus and finish in Fairbanks or Juneau. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
The state's version of the Eisenbeck land swap bill passed the state's House of Representatives last night and will now go on to the governor. The bill passed through the Senate earlier this week. The bill gives the Department of Natural Resources the authority to trade 43,000 acres of state land to the Eisenbeck National Wildlife Refuge in exchange for the 206 acres needed to build a one-lane road corridor through the wilderness area to connect King Cove with the airport in Cold Bay. Della Trumbull with the King Cove Corporation has been working on the land exchange for close to 30 years.
I equated this to the saying that it's another small step for mankind. I mean, this whole thing has been ongoing for so long, and it's been a number of small steps, I think, for us to get to where we are today and to continue to move forward slowly. It's huge, and we're just so very, very thankful.
The King Cove Corporation will also give an additional 15,000 acres to the refuge as part of the exchange. Trumbull says that the harsh weather in King Cove makes transportation to and from the airport via boat or hovercraft unreliable and dangerous. Patients get trapped without help.
As recently as last month, we had a situation where an 8 or 9 year old little boy broke his leg sledding on a Friday, and because of the bad weather, could not get to Cold Bay at all by any mode of transportation until that Monday.
The Aleutians East Borough says that once the road is built and community members have constant access to safe transportation, they will decommission the hovercraft that currently connects King Cove to Cold Bay. Representative Bryce Edgman, who introduced the original bill last session, says the DNR needs statutory authority to exchange lands that are of unequal value and involve tidelands. He says the final passage of the bill is an important step in the land exchange process.
The bill did pass both the House and the Senate without a single vote of opposition, which was pretty important in terms of sending the message back east that this is a real important issue to, you know, not just the community of King Cove and the Aleutians East Borough, but it's a pretty important issue to the state as a whole.
The Aleutians East Borough and the residents of the communities still face more hurdles before the land exchange is complete and the road is built. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service needs to complete an environmental impact statement for the project, and the Secretary of Interior needs to see if the exchange is in the better interest of the public. If the project goes through, the 10-mile-long section of the road through the wilderness area would be one lane wide, made of gravel, and have steel cables on each side to prevent people from driving off. Environmentalists have vehemently opposed the exchange for years because the area for the proposed road includes critical habitats, such as eelgrass beds and wetlands, which would not be part of the new acreage. The land swap also includes 1,600 acres near Kodiak that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service already planned on conveying to the state. The University of Alaska Regents were not scheduled to decide on a tuition increase at their meeting this week in Dillingham, but that didn't stop students from speaking against the proposal. Mike Mason reports from member station KDLG.
The proposal to increase the tuition at the University of Alaska was put forward by outgoing university president Mark Hamilton, who cited the economic outlook for the state and country, along with increases in day-to-day costs such as health care, as reasons to call for a tuition increase. The proposal is to increase tuition on lower division classes another 5% on top of the already approved 5% increase for the 2011-2012 school year. The proposal also calls for another 10-12% hike in tuition for the 2012-2013 school year. Peter Finn represents the Coalition of Student Leaders, and he told the Regents that a 10% hike in tuition is too high.
We are not only having tuition increases, we're also having student fee increases. We're also having rent go up. We're also having the cost of living from food go up. And altogether, it's becoming much more difficult for students to be able to afford to go to college full-time, or it's just like making it more difficult to afford that one extra class that might help them graduate on time.
Tuition at the University of Alaska has increased by nearly 30% in the last 5 years, but that's quite a bit less than the 48% increase that's been recorded in the western region of the U.S. over that same time frame. Another student government representative who made the trip to Dillingham for the Board of Regents meeting was Amy Stanley, who attends the University of Alaska Anchorage.
We're looking at the goals of increased enrollment, and we say that we have two groups of students who are affected by this, those who can't afford scholarships and those who can afford the increased tuition costs. We tend to overlook the ones who can't afford. But I also think there's an assumption we operate under that those who can't afford the scholarships in many ways are a necessary evil, that we have to bear that cost.
On Thursday, several UAA students gathered on the campus in Anchorage to protest the proposed tuition increase, which will not be decided by the Regents until they meet in September. The university reports that the average undergraduate tuition cost is now about $4,500 a year, and if the proposed tuition increase goes into effect, that cost could increase to over $5,700 a year by the fall of 2012. In Dillingham, I'm Mike Mason.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Shane Iverson in Bethel, Alan Lockyer in Anchorage, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Ann Hillman in Unalaska, Mike Mason in Dillingham, and the CBC's Philippe Morin in Inuvik. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Laurie Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by North Rim Bank, reminding you that you have a second chance to help other Alaskans. If you filed for your PFD online, you can safely donate a portion of your dividend to your favorite Alaska cause. Log into the PFD website and pick, click, give. Does your child not look at you when you talk to him? Are you worried your child doesn't play with other children? Or do you wonder why your child seems to be in her own world? Well, these could be the early signs of autism. For more information about autism and resources in your community, visit autism.alaska.gov or call 1-800-799-7570. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services. APRN brings news about Alaska to public radio every weekday. APRN, we cover the stories that impact the lives of all Alaskans.